From UCB Comedy Studios, this is the UCB Digital Podcast. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Excited that you're here today for an exciting episode for lovers of the filmmaking craft. We've got a good one just for you today. Our guest on our show, Chloe Smolkin, who I realized in recording this episode just how long we've been working together. We've been working on stuff for, God, I think probably like 5 or 6 years, going back to some Improv Everywhere projects. Back in the sort of like early part of this decade, and a lot of commercial projects and comedy projects in between then and now. We're talking to Chloe, who's a DP, about her growth and process working in the camera department. So all the way from a camera PA, first assistant, all the way up through DPing features and commercials and all the various types of work she does now, making her living as a DP. So excited to talk about that, excited to dig into that, and glad that you are here to join us for this episode. Ben Hosley's also here. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Nate.
Welcome back, buddy. I know you've been sick for a few days.
Yeah, I'm feeling a lot better. Nasty case of strep throat, but terrible.
Nasty.
But back, to it.
You're back and better than ever. And just in time as the weather turns here in New York from absolutely disgusting to wonderful. So good timing on your part to be sick while it was gross out, and now it's you're better just in time to go out and enjoy some sunshine.
That's the brighter side to that, sure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We're looking on the bright side for you, pal.
Thanks.
Hey, I sent out a link to this on Twitter this week, but Ben, I don't know if you saw this, but did you see this movie End of the Cul-de-Sac on Vimeo?
I have not.
Okay. So you should check it out, man. It is fucking amazing. And if anybody hasn't seen it, go check it out. It was like a staff pick from day one. In fact, I think that Vimeo has supported this film beforehand. I don't know the exact story, but I think that Vimeo has been a supporter of this guy, because this guy, Paul Trillo, great filmmaker and very invested in that Vimeo sort of like filmmaking community. And then the thing that makes this film cool is that he basically, it all takes place at the end of this cul-de-sac. That's why it's called The End of the Cul-de-Sac. And it plays out like a play. It's one shot continuous, uncut, from a drone. So it's
amazing.
It just plays. So it's 10 minutes long. And there's like a bunch of behind the scenes stuff about it on Vimeo too. I like consumed it all. Just like the craft of it is impeccable. And the content is really great. And it's just like such a cool movie and such a cool idea. So it's just like really visually inspiring. And I know I got a lot of like new ideas and new sort of like creative inspiration from watching it. So check it out if you haven't. The link is on our Twitter at UCB Digital as well. And I think that sort of dovetails well into our conversation today, because we're all about visual filmmaking today. Talking to our good buddy, Chloe Smolkin, who, as I mentioned before, I've worked with a lot, and she's been working in all different types of visual filmmaking, including storyboards, working her way up through the camera department in commercial productions and in features and in documentary stuff. We shot a bunch of hidden camera stuff together last year, and a commercial project last fall. And one of my favorite people to collaborate with. But Chloe's a dedicated and diehard director of photography, visual filmmaker, and somebody with a lot of skills and a lot of different experience to offer. And so we sort of dig into it with her. So for all the lovers of visual filmmaking, this is an episode for you, and we hope you enjoy it. Chloe and I also enjoyed the Belgian-style pale ale from Bronx Brewery. Ben, have you tried that one?
I did.
You have?
I don't normally like Belgian beers, because they're like sort of like usually like very
wheat-centric
of beers, but this was nice. This was like nice because, again, it's a hybrid, like pale. So it still has some of that hoppiness that I like, but a little bit of balance then with the wheat.
I have to taste it again. On their website, they say that some of the flavors involved are bubblegum, tangerines, smoky cloves, and bananas. Which, as I was drinking it, I was just thinking, this tastes like a good, you know, pale ale.
Right.
I wasn't looking for those notes, but that is a very specific set of tastes that now the next time I'm going to look for each of those things. Bubblegum, tangerines, smoky cloves, and bananas. Let's go try one right now, Ben, while this episode plays.
All right, let's do it.
Let's do it. And for everybody else, enjoy a Bronx later. Check out thebronxbrewery.com. They're the official house beer of the UCB Comedy Podcast Network. And please enjoy our conversation with Chloe Smolkin. So
So I see that you bill yourself on your website. On your website and on additional sites as cinematography and storyboards. Is that like, are those right. your two main sources? Do you still do storyboards or was that something you did before?
Yeah, I still do storyboards.
That's cool.
You know, I've storyboarded a lot of commercials.
Yeah.
I've storyboarded every feature that I've shot.
Cool.
Yeah, mostly TV shows don't ask for storyboards, but... commercials, definitely, because you got to sell
right.
like 11,
what the visual's gonna be.
11 clients yeah. on the same,
same thing.
Shots.
Uh-huh. Probably saves a lot of time in production.
Oh,
to have
yeah.
those pictures there. How did you get started in the camera department or the storyboard? I guess I was wondering if storyboards was a gateway towards camera department or whether how that all came together.
Yeah, it was actually. I started out wanting to be an animator. I went to college with the idea that I was going to be an animator.
Really?
But I went to NYU, which doesn't have an animation major. It just has film/animation.
Uh-huh.
So they made me take film classes. And I started really young. So by the time I got to college, I was assisting at an animation company.
Yeah.
And they had this like tiny room with no windows. Nobody ever talked to each other.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't what I had envisioned working in animation to be like.
Okay.
So I'd seen all these like Disney behind the scenes, everybody working together and people pitching their ideas
yeah.
and everybody like
yeah.
looking at each other's drawings. And that wasn't.
This was not that.
No, not at all. Nobody would talk for the whole day. So at the same time, I was at school being made to work on films and just loving it.
Yeah.
And kind of realizing that the thing that I really liked was creating images and telling stories.
Yeah.
And in cinematography, you don't have to draw all of those things.
Sure,
They're just kind of there.
I mean, some of the most visual, like the most visually talented people, like directors and cinematographers that I know have that animation background. I think because so much of good animation is about some of that shot selection and sort of building you are literally building every aspect of the visual. So you're very mindful to how shots connect and how to use camera movement to enhance the sort of like story elements you're trying to get across, right?
Yeah, that's right. Like if you start in, say, like documentary yeah. or reality, you yeah. might come from a mindset of like, here are things I can't change.
Yeah.
Like how can I just kind of tweak them?
Yeah.
But coming from animation, it's kind of like, these are all the things that are possible.
Right.
Which ones should we do?
I think that's really interesting because that's my background. I started editing in a documentary environment was like the
uh-huh.
first big jobs I had. And it was very much like, we're going to shape this thing out of what we have. You know what I mean? And if we can't, then that scene is gone.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Like if we can't build a scene that works, then that footage goes away. But this is the bulk of whatever 1,000 hours that we have to like put together into.
Yeah.
You know, into the contest. It's like a total opposite
yeah.
approach.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
So you realized that you didn't necessarily want to be on an animation side, but you still have that skill set. So
yeah,
you...
and I still liked storyboarding. You know, animation was a little bit repetitive
yeah.
for mm-hmm. me because, you know, you're drawing everything 24 frames per second, just
yeah.
a little bit different than the last one.
Mm-hmm.
But storyboarding is just like, here's the shot, here's the shot, here's the shot, which was more appealing to me. So I still do that. I haven't storyboarded for animation in a while, but I've been storyboarding for live action commercials and features.
Sure.
Some that I'm shooting and a couple that other people are shooting.
And so as you sort of got into the more of, you know, into the more professional world out of school, you're working in the camera department initially. And what was the sort of track that you've taken on that side of the business?
So I was coming up through the camera department. I started PAing on reality TV shows while I was in college. So when I got out of college, I already had all these connections and all this experience and just started ACing before I even got out on TV shows. And, you know, shooting whatever I could get my hands on, shooting low-budget short films, shooting improv everywhere, shooting whatever I could, and building my reel and meeting new people. And that just led to more and more commercials and eventually features.
Have you ever had a day job, or has it always been sort of like on a gig basis?
I've never had a day job. I mean, I don't know if you would count. I was a teacher for kids of animation.
Okay.
Which was every day.
Okay.
So I taught animation to a class of 5 to 10-year-olds and then a class of 11 to 15-year-olds.
Really?
Yeah.
How long was that for?
It was a summer class. So I think I did it 2 years. So it was like 3 months.
I'd still call that a gig.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? If it's just a summer thing. It's a
nobody's
months.
Ever given me health insurance.
Okay,
I can
well,
tell you that.
That's one of the clear distinctions of a job.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. So you sort of made that grind work ever since getting out of school.
Yeah.
So I guess on your way up, to talk about the early days of it, because I think I'm definitely interested in like how you've built what the links in the chain of, you know, building a career in cinematography is like. What relationships are you developing when you're sort of going into either those PA jobs or your first sort of like camera department jobs? Because you're probably not DPing something big out of the gate.
Right.
So what are the relationships you're developing, and what's your sort of focus at that phase of the process?
So at that stage, when you're just ACing, you're really trying to make yourself indispensable to the DP.
Yeah.
You know, and a really important part of it is not only listening to them, what they need, but also anticipating what they need. Like if you see them plugging in one end of a monitor, if you go run and plug in the other end, they'll be like, oh, wow, you're on top of it.
Sure.
So stuff like that. And then so you build trust with these DPs that you're working with. Uh-huh. And then eventually you can drop hints that you want to operate.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody loves a cheap operator. So you start acing and operating on the same shoot. And then you start just operating.
Yeah. That's really funny.
Get hired to just operate.
I told you, I just talked to Keith like a couple of weeks ago, and he had a similar thing. He was like, yeah, I would do this stuff for no money. And everyone was like, sure, I'll hire you.
Yeah.
Which like when you're on the other side of that, you're like, oh man, that's like, that sucks that like, that's why people who are further along don't get jobs. But when it's your first thing, or when you're trying to build something, you're looking for credits.
Right.
Like, it is such an invaluable thing to put yourself out there and be like, I'll do it. Because at that point, the trade-off is great for you.
Right.
Right?
Right. Like, I'm at the point where people who are PAs are meeting me on a set, and they're being like, I really want to be in the camera department. Like, if there's I can, like, work for free, or, like, if you want to bring me. And I'm like, oh. I mean, I have this shoot where we can only afford a first AC and we can't pay the second AC. Do you, I mean, you don't want to do, you do want to do that. Okay, great. You're hired.
Yeah.
So.
Feeling a need.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there's always more needs than there is budget.
Right.
No matter what phase of the process you're at.
It's weird, you know, like it can be a $500,000 movie. And there's not enough. It can be a $1 million movie.
Yeah.
And it's not enough. I don't know why.
Yeah. I remember, I think one of my aunts and uncles once said to me that, like, the reason that you sort of save for retirement, right? You sort of make that sort of plan is because your budget will always stretch to the limits of what you have available. Like your lifestyle will always stretch to the limits of your budget,
yeah.
Right? So you want to, so like in that context, it's like put aside 5%, put aside 10% because you'll make the rest of it work given what you have access to in your life at that time. So I think it's a similar idea in production where it's like, as soon as there's like, because anything is possible, anything yeah. is possible. And if you can throw more money at it, more becomes possible, right? There still reaches a limit to that.
Right.
But then if you throw more money at it, more becomes possible. Yeah. So if you're working on something that has some sort of fixed limit, like, of course, you're going to max it out. You're going to go 100%.
Yeah.
Especially if it's a client thing. They want to know that every dollar possible is being spent on what's going to be on camera.
I can't wait, right? though, until I'm complaining that $50 million is not enough.
Isn't enough money? Hey, those are called good problems.
Yeah.
All right, so you're making yourself indispensable in that way. And you also mentioned like the stuff like Improv Everywhere. Is that also the kind of environment where you can take more of a chance on yourself? Because I think that one of the things that Charlie's operation, especially in those years, this was like 2009, 2008, right?
Yeah. When did I start doing it? I think I started doing it in 2008.
Yeah.
And, you know, at first I was just doing it for free.
Yeah.
And
because he used to sort of just say, if you want to shoot it, come and shoot it,
yeah.
which meant that you got to call yourself a shooter of content that was going to get a lot of views.
Yeah.
A lot of people got good camera credits off of those videos in those days because
yeah.
Charlie was doing it off of a bootstrap. And the people who he was getting were the kind of people who were like ambitious enough to be like, I want this credit. So I guess, were you actively looking for those opportunities too, where you could have a little bit more of a... creative contribution outside of a big camera department?
I think at the time I was more drawn to Improv Everywhere because it was not as soul-sucking as the other things I was doing, which were
valid
reality TV.
Very valid.
So it was the same kind of style. I could show them that I had experience working in this kind of genre,
yeah.
but we were making fun stuff that was making people happy as opposed to making artificially dramatic stuff that was making people feel bad.
Okay, I can dig that. I guess what I'm wondering is where in the process do you make a leap from being in a camera department that somebody else is heading to putting yourself in the position to have opportunities to do it for yourself, to lead that department? Is like, what's that leap?
That's a good question. For me, my first like nationally broadcast TV show, I started as an operator on, and the DP got sick and had to quit, and they promoted me.
Wow.
So,
and what show was that?
That was called Quirky.
Okay.
It was on the Sundance Channel.
Oh, okay.
But the crazy thing is the rug commercial I just mentioned to you when I got here.
Yeah.
I got that because of one of the people, one of the inventors who was on the show.
Really?
Yeah.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
I mean, everything comes around.
Yeah. It's all meeting people and
yeah.
having people see you do a good job.
Yeah.
You know, under tough circumstances or, you know, with less equipment than
yeah.
you wanted, and they see that you can be creative and make it work,
yeah.
and then they want you to do everything that they do.
Okay. And so you're in a position, though, where you, like, take a job and then you sort of have an opportunity come to you because you're already in position to take advantage of the opportunity that came up.
Right.
And you start to, and then you can say that you're the next thing? It's like, you go from operator to DP and you're like, now I'm a DP?
To market
yourself that way? Or how does it become, how do you make that leap from like one-time opportunity to, no, now I can handle this level?
I think after that, I started migrating from reality to news magazines.
Okay.
So, and that was also like, you know, it was, we got to light things a little bit. We got to travel a little bit. We got to, you know, inform people more than the reality shows. So that felt even better.
Mm-hmm.
Liked being able to light things and have the producers care about what it looked like a little bit more.
And I guess in terms of like, so it sounds like then the opportunity that you had first at the level of DP was not necessarily inside the genre where you were most passionate.
Right.
So then is it, is the move towards the kind of content that you're interested in? Before you mentioned that you're most interested in, what is it?
Magical realism.
Okay. So to migrate into that kind of content that you're more passionate about, because again, I don't know, like that feels like a common story, right? You get opportunities, but it's not inside of but it's in reality. And I'm not passionate about that. So to move laterally in that same position, but towards the subjects that you're interested in, how do you do that without taking a step back? Or did you have to take a step back in the, you know what I mean?
Yeah. part of what helped was that a lot of people were wanting to move away from reality so yeah. they could, you know, you'd get recommended by, you know, a producer who yeah. used to shoot for, who's yeah. now doing narrative stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, like my first feature was just, you know, a friend of a friend who knew that I could do a lot with a very small budget.
Yeah.
And it
was sort of like an opportunity to be like, I can do this excellent work. I know I can handle this project, and this is more in the style of what I want to be doing. So maybe there's less money involved, and it's worth it to still take the chance?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Do you feel like that's how much has the consideration of money been a factor in job selection for you?
Well, it definitely was what drove the
initially?
Reality
yeah.
TV
yeah.
stuff,
cause, yeah.
and that was very hard to quit because the reality rates were like twice the rates of everything else. So yeah.
But there's a price for that.
Money is a consideration, but. Lately, for me, money has been a consideration, like not just because I have to live and I have to have an apartment and
yeah.
that kind of stuff, but also because if the budget of the project is too small, I can't have the assistants that I like to work with.
Okay.
Or, you know, I can't have the time that we need to make it look good
yeah.
or... You know, it's just going to be kind of a mad dash.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that a little bit. What is the kind of environment that you like to work in that way? Like, what's the type of department that you like? What do you look for in the people who you want to, you know, bring into that department? And what's the environment on a production that's, like, ideal for you from your perspective as a DP?
The people that I like to work with, you know, they usually either come recommended to me or they'll just be, like, given to me. Like, I was shooting a thing for History Channel in Boston and, you know, the producer just hired a local gaffer for me and he was awesome. His attitude was great. He knew his shit.
Yeah.
And... he was just great.
That's great.
So now he's my gaffer on everything. Like I bring him
you
down
bring him
from
New York.
Boston.
That's great.
Whenever I can.
Yeah. So that's but in that circumstance you don't have a choice. When you're saying that most of the time it's like relationships that you've already developed.
Yeah.
Here's what I wonder. What are the qualities in those people when you're on, like you were saying on when you're on the lower side of that relationship, right? The lower status side of the relationship, you were trying to solve problems. Are those the same qualities you're looking for actively in people to bring back on things? Or what are the qualities in people inside of a department that you're running that you wish more people had?
Yeah.
That's the question.
Definitely. I'm looking for people who are either knowledgeable or very eager and willing to learn.
Okay.
You know, if you have an intern who doesn't know anything, but they're eager to help and they're eager to learn, then that's perfect. That's great. Also, good attitude. You know, shoots can be long hours. They can be tiring. Things can be unfair.
Yeah.
And so it's all people who keep a good attitude that I hire.
Yeah.
You know, there can be like that stereotype of like the gruff key grip who's always surly and mad at the world.
Sure.
But like I can't handle that. I can't have that on my team. Like I need, not that they have to be like rays of sunshine all the time, but just like working together to get the job done and do a good job.
Yeah, I can dig it. And then in terms of the kind of environment on a production that makes you sort of like happy or unhappy, what are you like in picking a project or like looking for things? What are you looking for in the production that's going to make you happy? Is it about access to new tech? Is it about travel? Is it about, you know, quality of the work? Like, what are you looking, how do you analyze that in terms of like picking a job?
I think a lot of it is either a good relationship with the director or producer and or a really good script.
Yeah.
You know, something that allows some creativity and making beautiful images.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my favorite kind of thing.
I can take it. How much do the toys play in? There's some DPs who you feel like you're like, oh, the way to really convince them to do this job, the way to make sure they're happy is to like have fancy new toys on it. You know what I mean?
Right. I'm not really like that. I've definitely like seen it because when I'm being interviewed, a lot of times the people interviewing me will be like, "What camera do you have to use?"
Yeah,
and I'm like, "Well,
you have to use."
Well, it depends on the project and it depends on your budget.
Yeah,
I have my preferences, but I'm not like I have to have these things.
Yeah,
you know, I like to have a nice dolly and track.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I've also had some great times doing handheld shoots.
Sure.
Doing shoots where we couldn't afford a dolly. We just had sticks.
Uh-huh.
And the script didn't call for any movement.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's no one thing.
Okay. Is there any sort of, like, so there's no attraction to a project based on like what the camera package available is. I guess let me just ask you what camera, like if you could have your druthers, what is the camera package that appeals to you?
Well, the Alexa is my favorite camera right now.
Yeah.
If it's a handheld shoot, then the Amira, but you know it has the best noise pattern. It has the best color rendition. There are other cameras that come close, but it's my favorite.
Yeah. That's cool. We are drinking the Belgian style pale ale. That's an abrupt change, but cheers to you.
Cheers.
From Bronx Brewery. I haven't tried this one. This is the first time I'm trying this one. I'm on a little tasting tour as we have all this Bronx in the office right now. It's nice. It's like a little smooth. It's higher alcohol volume, 6.7%. But a very good one. The Bronx Brewery Belgian Style Pale Ale.
We're probably not allowed to talk about other beers, but at DCM, they were sponsored by Narragansett, which I thought that I didn't like.
You do?
But then I got it for free, and I loved it.
That's really funny. No, Bronx was a DCM sponsor, too. So I think Narragansett and Bronx, they're friends. They're friends. It's all Northeast beers.
They'll go out and get a beer together.
Yeah, exactly. Is there, I guess, I mean, personally, I feel kind of awkward asking this question, Chloe, but like, it feels like it's relevant. The camera department must be like a boys club in some ways. Have you felt
very
like,
much so?
Yeah,
very much. I mean, it's getting better, but it's still. I just heard that 3% of the top grossing Hollywood movies are shot by women.
Yeah,
there's only 6% women in the ASC, the American Society of Cinematographers.
Yeah,
so it's getting better. Like when I was in AC, I knew one female DP.
Yeah.
So it's definitely getting better, but it's
slow.
Yeah, it's slow.
Do you feel like you've seen any sort of like impact there in terms of like the opportunities that you've gotten or the development that you've had? Like, because I you're one of my favorite people to work with. Period.
You're one of my favorite people to work with too.
Thank you, Chloe. But I definitely know that it's like a lot of dudes and a lot of like it's such a relationship based thing.
Yeah.
Too. Everything you're talking about is you get recommended. You get an opportunity because somebody likes you. You get an opportunity because you did this on this, but it's also so fucking interpersonal. You
right.
know what I mean?
And I've had several times where I've been up for a job and I know the DP who got the job.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say this about many people, but in these two specific instances that I'm thinking about, I know that I'm more talented than the people who got the job. Like one of them I trained and he was still not quite at my level yet.
Yeah.
And the other one I just knew.
Yeah.
But they look like what you think of when you think of DP.
Yeah.
They look rugged and super confident and bearded usually.
And those are, you're definitely confident, but the other aspects of what you're describing are not how I would describe you. It doesn't seem like you've adapted that mentality to be like, this
bearded is
how I have to get across in this business.
Yeah.
Right? It's not, doesn't seem like it's changed your approach.
Well, yeah. I mean, I can't make myself bearded, so
yes,
there's that.
But you could walk into those same meetings where you're saying they're asking what camera package you have to have, and you could be an asshole about it.
Right.
And you could make demands that are like, if I'm going to take this job, this is how I need it to be, the way that like
that's true.
A DP is expected to be.
That's true. I don't know. And, I don't know for sure that the way I'm doing it is necessarily the best way, but
yeah.
It is how I've been doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that the people who are swayed by super masculine cockiness are not going to be the same people who would pick me.
Sure.
Even if I tried to.
To do that.
Display super masculine cockiness.
I can dig that. I can dig it.
The people that I do work with are either, they're smart enough to see through those other people or they're looking for someone who will be more positive attitude and problem solving and, working for the greater good on set.
I mean, I definitely appreciate it because I think that there's an element of that. There's an element of the kind of attitude that DPs have sometimes that becomes counterproductive for the best interest of the project because it becomes about the needing to have certain structure of department or needing to have certain access to toys or time
there are certain times where I'll fight for a certain structure and it's usually that they'll be like, we don't need a second AC.
Yes.
And I'll be like, this is the only person, this is the only job, the only person who, with a very easy mistake, could wipe out your whole day's shooting.
Yeah.
So.
How about you invest in that?
Yeah. So let's not try to have someone do that in their, like, bathroom break time.
I can dig it. How about this? Here's another question. In terms of like your relationship with directors, if you're going to give advice to directors about working with a DP, I mean, I'd say producers too.
Uh-huh.
What are the qualities of that relationship and the points of input creatively, technically, budgetarily that you like to have as a DP that you wish more directors and producers knew inside the relationship of working fruitfully with a DP?
Well, I think the most important quality of a director, like, you know, some directors are like, oh, I'm so embarrassed, I don't know anything about lenses or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, you don't need to know literally anything. That's why you have me. Just like, tell me a movie or a photo that you like the way it looks and I'll make it happen. So to me, being a director, the most important quality is having some sort of vision, having something that's guiding your decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And then also just like being able to steer the ship, make sure everyone's making the same movie together. And that's really the most important part. I don't think you have to know how to do anyone else's job. You just need to really just be a good manager.
Okay, I can dig it. And then maybe for producers in terms of like thinking about the allocations of a department, or like, I guess, you know, where do you like to be sort of like positioned in the process? You said you had a good experience with a gaffer being added that you didn't know.
Right.
It's out of your control. Like, what do you wish more producers would communicate with DPs about?
Right now, the thing I most wish that producers thought about was color correction.
Yeah.
You know, because everybody's shooting on these cameras that shoot raw now, the Alexa or Sony cameras or Canon cameras, they all shoot, you know, raw or S-log. You can't just throw that up on screen. It looks low contrast and muddy and it looks like you shot it wrong. You have to color correct it, and they're not saving money in the budget for that. So I wish they would do that, because there have been some projects where I have to like swoop in and do the color correction for, you know, like a third of what it should cost.
Uh-huh.
Because that's all they have left.
Right. And
it has to be done.
How often are you coloring projects that you're shooting? You like to do that?
I do like to do it.
Yeah.
It's nice to sit on a couch with the director and have someone else be at the computer with a big monitor.
Sure.
But you can't always afford that.
Right.
Yeah.
What's the frequency, like what would you say percentage-wise of the projects you're shooting that you're also coloring?
I think I'm probably coloring like 2/3 of the projects that I shoot.
That's significant.
Yeah.
That's definitely significant.
Yeah. My DaVinci Resolve is getting a workout.
Yeah. Getting the skills.
Yeah.
Getting those skills. And then, you know, let me go back to the storyboarding thing, because that just reminded me of that. Where did that fit into this in the process? Where were you doing a lot of story? Like, what phase of your career were you doing a lot of that storyboarding? Was that like in a hustle phase?
Or the whole time.
Yeah. The whole time.
Yeah. I guess the first big thing that I storyboarded was a promo for TNT, and that was while I was in college. And then, you know, I'm still storyboarding. We get commercials and features, so.
That's cool. That is an area where I have literally zero skill. Storyboarding is something that I am not good at. I cannot draw.
It's funny because some directors can't draw, and then they try to make storyboards for you anyway. And they'll be like, you know, the first shot will be 3 stick figures, full body stick figures.
Yeah.
And you'll be like, okay, so like a wide shot, head to toe, and the 3 people are lined up. And they're like, no, I want it to be like like here, like from chest up.
Yeah, but you drew the 2 sticks that are the people. Yeah, no. I think I storyboarded one project in college as an assignment.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, I am no good at this. It makes no sense. It just frustrates me.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I'm a shot list person.
Yeah.
But I understand the value of it. But it's like, for me to do it means getting somebody else to do it.
Yeah. It's great for DPing because I don't know how other DPs do it. But like, I've got little tiny storyboards on the script, so, like keeping track of the visual flow and like the last shot, the focus was here. Yeah. So in the next shot, the focus will be over here.
Yeah.
And
yeah. That's cool. That's rad. And then, you know, the last question I have is in terms of like thinking about building a career in the camera department for folks, two questions. One, even at the phase you're at, because like freelancing as an editor, when I was freelancing as an editor, I was working every day. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Because it was every project needed something and you were always picking up more. It was like literally 7 days a week of editing something, even if it was that seventh day was something for me at home, uh-huh. You know, in a camera department freelance environment, how many days a month are you working? How many days a week are you working? Because it's a little bit less of a daily.
It's confusing because it's like, do you mean how many days am I on set or like storyboarding something that is actively due tomorrow? Or do you mean how many days am I working?
How many days is a project in a month, like, you know, giving you a day rate?
Uh-huh.
That's what I would call it. Okay. The rest of it is like, yeah, it's working.
Yeah.
Let's start there.
Okay.
And then maybe back into the wider view of like all the little things that aren't work in air quotes, but that are.
Yeah. It's so, probably like 10 days a month I'm either on set or actively storyboarding or color correcting something that is like due tomorrow or the next day or whatever.
Yes.
But then like maybe like 25, 26 days a month I'm doing work. I'm, you know, getting equipment quotes and hiring my crew and or like looking at scout photos and or color correcting something that's not due for a long time or color correcting something that I already shot and they put out without color correcting and I want to color correct it before I put it on my website.
Yeah. Okay. So that's more than 30 days a month.
Yeah.
So it's a daily. It's every day.
Most days.
Yeah.
It's like 25, 26 days a month.
Yeah. And is it, like, I guess in terms of, like, your year, how much time are you traveling as a freelancer?
It varies. You know, like, some years I'm going to, like, 10 different countries.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, like, some years I'm, like, just going to, like, Los Angeles and middle of nowhere, Florida.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it varies a lot.
Rad. All right, cool. Well, this is very, very fun. Very
good
to catch up with
you. Is very fun. Thanks for having me.
Cheers.
Cheers.
All right, that'll do it for episode number 39 of this show. Thank you so much for tuning into this one. Thanks to Chloe for sitting down, taking the time, sharing a beer with me and sharing her story. Hope that you got something out of it out there. And hopefully it helps you as you're sort of approaching your work and making it as visually dynamic and beautiful as possible. Thanks to the Bronx Brewery for supplying that Belgian-style pale ale that we drank during this episode. You can check out all of the Bronx Brewery's craft beers at their website, thebronxbrewery.com. And when you're out next time, if you're at the UCB East Bar or at any number of bars around New York City and around the East Coast, make your next pint a Bronx. You will not regret it. And when you do, send us a tweet or a Facebook message. We're on there. We're interacting. We want to talk to you about your drinking habits, about your filmmaking habits, about all the habits you have in your life. At UCB Digital on Twitter, at UCB Digital Podcast on Facebook. And give us a subscription on iTunes if you would be so kind. That's how we know that you really love us. And you can rate us and review us if you feel inclined to do that as well. We're always happy to connect with you about the subjects that matter to you. And UCB is on social media across the spectrum. Vimeo, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, the whole thing, at UCB Comedy. Check us out. New videos all the time, including a brand new video that has just come out today. If you're listening to this on release day, a new short from our good friends Brinkman and director Dennis Cardino is on our Vimeo page at UCB Comedy. Check it out. We're back next week with another great episode of this show. And until then, y'all, we'll see you on the internet.
This has been a UCB Comedy production. Check out our other shows on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network.